I can't control God.
It's a risk you're taking, you know?
I can't control the wind or God. So then it's, then I will call out the tour director, but I'm just saying that if the wind blows, there's nothing I can do about that. I can't control God. Talk to him.
Hello, everybody. Welcome back to The Body Serve. I'm Jonathan.
I'm James.
Were you startled by my volume there?
The enthusiasm.
We took a week off. Only Monte Carlo was happening, really.
Billie Jean King Cup was happening. I felt like it was a light week. It was a good time to take a break. Mm.
We won't be covering Billie Jean King Cup on this because I still don't know anything really about it. That's clearly my fault, but I don't know the format, don't really know how it works, who advances where, blah, blah, blah.
Mm-hmm. It's... Mm-hmm. You've only had how many years at this point to learn the new system? Actually, you don't even know how many years.
They channeled their very best Sarah McLachlan with this tournament because they certainly built a mystery to me.
Oh. Wow. Did you just think of that?
I did. We love that you all seem to love our Charleston episode.
Yeah, the response was... very, very cool to see. I hope we've inspired a few people to attend Charleston in the future. I hope that the tournament saw that we inspired people to attend Charleston and will, you know, send us a little love via maybe a ticket or two.
Oh, you think that that's going to happen?
I just want to reassure you that the episode was not payola. There was no sponsored content whatsoever. We just really liked it.
Mm-hmm. Two things. You said to me in the aftermath of people listening to the episode and, you know, sending us messages, wow, I guess I really should be more positive because there seems to be a correlation.
I'm like, wow, this is what they wanted all along.
And also, we've been asked in the past and we've toyed with the idea before and just never really knew how it would come about. But perhaps we have a TBS meetup/event in Charleston next year. If we decide to go and if y'all are serious about going based on our episode, you know, maybe it would work.
Yeah. So think about it. Let us know if you are coming because it's something we're seriously considering on a more official basis than just kind of running into people at tournaments.
Let's begin with Monte Carlo, won by Stefanos Tsitsipas, someone who had only reached the quarterfinal round of a tournament twice this year. Prior to this event, he got his groove back in Monaco.
It's the most likely place for it to happen. It's the site of two other titles won by him. His only three Masters 1000 titles have been at Monte Carlo.
There's that @in.
At in, whatever.
He beat Echeverry, that guy, Khachanov, Sinner, and Ruud in the final. It's a good grouping of players that he beat that tournament.
It's a very, very good grouping. Especially that semifinal over Sinner, who, as many people said, wait until we transition to clay. This type of dominance may not be able to continue in the same way. That's not to say that Sinner can't win big on clay. It's just that it is going to take some time. His game is not naturally, or the most naturally suited to clay.
Okay. It's more of a reminder to me that there are certain players in tennis who, come clay season, they get their shit together.
Yes.
They are suited to the surface. They play well. They have a certain comfortability on the surface. And at this event on this surface, Tsitsipas it's his milieu.
Comfortability.
Well, is that not a word?
I mean, people say, I guess because...
Is this one of those corporate words that you rail against?
No. I would just say, why say comfortability when you could say comfort?
It was the way the words formed in my head. And came out my mouth.
It's fine. I really don't care. Stefanos had, of course, recently fallen out of the top 10 after being number 3 for a little while last year. This was a good time for him to get his rhythm back.
Also of note in Monte Carlo was Holger Rune. And not necessarily for his play on court, but as is typically the case these days, what he had to say off it. He made the quarterfinals in singles, in doubles as well, I believe. But he took great issue with the scheduling of the tournament due to rain delays. He was forced to play 2 matches in 1 day, finished very late, and then had to return the next day to play Yannick Sinner in the quarterfinals.
And it wasn't just that he had to play 2 matches. On Thursday, he played against Nagal and Dimitrov. The Dimitrov match lasted 3.5 hours, and he was on court for over 5 hours that day. So then coming back at 1 o'clock the next day versus Sinner, he was clearly pissed off.
He was triggered by the ATP Tour, by whoever's running their social media account. On Twitter, the ATP Tour said, "May the force be with you at Yannick Sinner at Rolex Masters." And that was captioning a video of Sinner beating Hruna. That really set him off. He quote tweets it and says, "Meaning what, ATP Tour? Not that you gave me the best conditions in the first place, having to play 2 matches the day before ending late, leaving almost no recovery time. Chair umpire making crucial mistakes and giving wrong warning that disturbed the game. May the force be with you, Jesus Christ."
Spicy. I feel like you emphasized "may the force be with you." I don't know that was where the emphasis was.
Does it matter? This is creative license on my part.
Do you think that he knows this is a Star Wars reference? I don't think he cares, but...
Do you think any Gen Z knows 5% of the cultural references that we do?
No, but I'm not even a Star Wars person.
Sure, but I'm just... Exactly. Even more reason why they wouldn't know. I don't know. Maybe I don't. This is immaterial.
Please continue.
Somebody responded to one of Holger's tweets and said, "Real champions don't cry like this. Lesson number one." To which Holger replied, "Hi, if I want to cry, I cry. If I want to scream, I scream. That's me. And by the way, I never cry." This post was mainly mentioning that it's probably the shortest tournament I had in a long time in Europe, and still, 3 matches. Very efficient.
I'm going to say, he had me in the first half.
I was hoping it was going somewhere else.
I cry because this is a bar, right? Like, he's setting up actual poetry here. And then he says, "but I never cry." And this is where he lost me, because, first of all, I feel that you have validated the point of that loser who just tweeted at you saying real champions never cry, whatever. First of all, real champions cry all the time.
All the time. Roger Federer.
Constantly.
In Australia, circa 2009?
Oh, yes. I can never forget
that. Oh, yes.
Real champions cry constantly, and they whine as well, Mr. MD. But Holger saying, "I never cry," is like, okay, well, good for you, I guess. We've mentioned a few times that Holger signing with ING has not doused the flame at all.
And you're glad for it. You are living for this.
He is the messy twink we always thought he was.
Since he has broadened his messy horizons and shortened his shorts, you have never been as big a fan of Holger as you are right now. You continue to be drawn in by this vortex of mess.
Because he is compelling. Now, the true test will be if he remains this messy at a tournament owned by his agency. Madrid is next, still owned by IMG. Will he continue? I would like to see it.
That presupposes impulse control. And maybe this is why you are in league with him right now. Because your impulse control is often wanting.
That's so interesting that that's how you see me. I just find that interesting. I won't accept or refute it.
Okay. This past week in Barcelona saw the return of Rafa Nadal. Previously, he had pulled out of Monte Carlo, unable to play there. And correct me if I'm wrong, but the way he talked about it then didn't give me the idea that he was just going to go to Barcelona and see if he could play there. It seemed to me at that point that he needed more time. But lo and behold, he shows up in Barcelona, gets through practice. We get news that, Rafa has a press conference tomorrow. And what in the hola todos is coming when you see that, right? Lo and behold, he's just letting everybody know that, hey, I'm going to play. He wins one match, opens against Flavio Cobolli, wins that 6-2, 6-3, and then loses his next match against Alex Dumanar.
A tough second round opponent for sure, somebody who's playing really well this year. I was surprised to see Rafa in the tournament at all. I knew that he was in Barcelona, but it's close to home. He wants to practice. He wasn't too injured to practice. And I guess at this point, he knows he can't just roll up into Paris and hope for the best. He's going to need match play coming into it, but he also has to remain very conservative because this is the last shot. Mm-hmm. This is it.
And we saw that with how he played. He has an amended serve. The serve is giving him problems. We still see booming forehands, electric forehands, the backhand cross court. Lots of things in his game is still there. But you get the sense that he's holding back. And he even hinted or even said as much in his post-match press conferences, saying, quote, "It wasn't today that I had to give everything and die. I have to give myself the chance to do that in a few weeks, or at least try to. I will try to take a step further in Madrid, then another one in Rome and in Paris. There is the moment to do it. Whatever happens, there is no better place to be."
Rafa likes to do this escalating repetition when he gives an answer, and it reminded me of something very famous, which I believe we used in an episode title. In 2019, he said, "What happened in Monte Carlo happened. What happened in Barcelona happened. What happened in Madrid happened. And here we are. We are in Rome." I wasn't planning on doing any kind of accent. That was not supposed to be an impersonation, by the way. Oh. I know it was not good, but I felt like it couldn't
be done. It sounded fine to me.
Oh, thank you. Just an absolute classic of a press conference, that one. But here we are. We are in, I don't know where we are. Are we going to Madrid? Are we going to Rome?
Well, Rafa is currently in Madrid.
He is. Is he going to play?
He intends to play.
Mm-hmm.
And perhaps there hasn't been any deterioration physically from his output in Barcelona, and so he's able to maybe try and build on that. There are two things at play here. Back in the day when Rafa would come back from injury or, say, a six-month absence, he would still have thousands upon thousands of points on his ranking.
Mm-hmm.
That would help him in draws. He could come back and get maybe a bye and then an easier first match and then ease into the tournament. This is no longer the case. And so everywhere he turns up, it's going to be difficult.
As you know, he did not drop out of the top 10 for about 18 years. So even after those long layoffs, he was guaranteed a seed for decades.
Mm-hmm.
That's not where we are. He will not be seeded for the French Open. I honestly thought his answers were more optimistic than I expected. And watching him play, I thought, well, it looks kind of similar to Netflix Slam. He's definitely slower moving around the court. The serve is not really there, but that could be prevention at this point. That could just be like taking care of his body, or it could mean he's not capable of doing something. I don't know which it is. But off the ground, he can still be very destructive, right? Damaging with his forehand, especially.
Yes, and on clay, I find that his backhand cross court is still the X factor.
Mm.
Even with diminished returns in other areas of his game, he can still open up the court like almost nobody can in tennis with that one shot. His most underrated shot, I feel. And if he's able to add clicks on the serve when he needs it, come the French Open, if he's able to get match play, win a few matches, and the body holds up, I'm not saying he could win the French Open. I'm saying it could be a decent event for him.
Yeah. I just don't know what we're in for. I think this week in Barcelona made me a little sad, but also gave me some hope. Because I was in a place probably the week prior where I was coming to accept that this just may never happen. That this may be a final season retirement tour that just isn't going to get off the ground. And I had to accept that. But now I have the tiniest sliver of hope that we could really put something together. But just the fact that this is, you know, that was the last Barcelona. We'll see the last Rome, the last French Open. Like, that stuff is hard to reckon with as a fan. For somebody you've been riding with for 20 years.
Right, but do we still know that definitively?
He said so.
Did he say it definitively, though?
I believe so.
All I've been hearing is like, well, I don't know. Maybe I'm wrong here.
We will still have the Olympics, though.
Will we?
Well,
if he dies in Paris.
Right. I wish he wouldn't feel the need to have to die on court, because there is life after tennis.
So that happened. That happened in Barcelona this week. A tournament won by Casper Ruud, his fourth final of the season. He plays Stefanos Tsitsipas in a final in back-to-back weeks. Stefanos winning in Monte Carlo, Casper winning this week in Barcelona. And he is up to number 6 in the world. Casper wins his first ATP 500 title.
The first title over that 250 level.
That's kind of crazy.
Mm-hmm.
This is somebody who's made 3 slam finals.
And it's funny, it actually would have been Tsitsipas' first 500 title. He's won higher level titles, but never the 500. And I think he's lost like 10 or 11 times at this point.
This is the third time that the two have played this year. I believe Casper leads 2-1. On his way to the final, well, on his way to the title, Casper beat Müller, Thompson, Arnaldi, Echeverri, and then Tsitsipas. I feel like Casper has this reputation of being a 1B star.
Right, right.
Not a legitimate star, not a legitimate somebody who's deserving of a slam title. And I think and I hope that this year, with his stretch of results, if he can build on it, he can brush that off. Did not care for his comments about short shorts this past week, because I've long maintained that that is one of the big problems with his kits. His kits are at least minimum 1 inch too long.
It makes him look shorter.
It makes him look shorter than he is. It gives disproportion. It just doesn't work for me.
Stefanos was also an anti-shorts shorts person on the video. Did I just say shorts shorts? Anyway, you know what I mean. Also a kind of losery opinion from Stefanos, because his shorts look consistently dopey.
They are pajamas. He's wearing crocus bags.
What?
That's for the Jamaican listeners.
Uh-huh. What does that mean?
Just big bags.
Okay.
That are, they're used as sacks to transport things.
Casper is a 3-time major finalist. He happened to run up against Djokovic, Nadal, and Alcaraz in those finals. But he is somebody, I think people were expecting him to dip and that he had achieved all he was going to achieve. He's only 25.
As if he were a Diego Schwartzman type figure.
Oh, damn.
Well.
Well.
I mean, Casper has achieved way more on the slam level. Yes. But Diego made quarterfinals. He made deep runs.
But Casper has been a top 10 player for quite a while now. He briefly dipped out of the top 10. I think he's here to stay for quite a while.
In Munich,
Jan-Lennard Struff wins the title, his first. At age 33, he had long been one of the best active players to not have won an ATP title, and he breaks that, beating Taylor Fritz. He, like Holger last week, had a packed day, but he got through it very quickly. He had to beat Felix Auger-Aliassime and Holger in the same day, beating Holger in 45 minutes. What happened there? I did not see that match, but the scoreline shocked me. Struff was the comeback player of the year last year on the ATP. He had been dealing with an injury the previous year, and he cut his ranking from 151 to 25 at the end of last year. Stuttgart is the first really prestigious clay title on the women's side in Europe.
Save
Charleston.
In Europe.
Yes.
I was about to tell you to shut your mouth.
Right, right. It's a strange tournament. It's this indoor clay, but they've, with the help of Porsche as their sponsor, have built up a lot of prestige around this tournament and have made it a legit part of that Euro clay swing.
You've had the full gamut of tennis players winning that tournament. Ash Barty, Iga Świątek, Petra Kvitová, Maria Sharapova. It tends to be the playground of the bigger hitters.
Mm-hmm.
Where somebody who may not feel as accomplished on clay can have good results on the surface. Pliskova plays well there too.
Right. Iga Świątek had been riding a 10-match win streak there. She won the last 2 titles. And guess who she runs up against? Elena Rybakina, who, despite dealing with illness, has had the most match wins of everybody this year, has reached 5 finals, winning 3 of them, and has a win each against the number 1 and number 2 players.
Is she gunning for that position that somebody seems to always occupy every year, where the player of the year conversation boils down to somebody who's won a couple big tournaments versus somebody who's had the consistent season? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. She's also showing that her baseline is still so high.
Yeah.
She's had a string of 3-set matches throughout the season where she's looked uneven, unsteady for large spells, but is still able to win these matches. And that is something that should scare the rest of the field. And with having beaten Iga all 3 times they played last year, was it? 3 or 4 times they played last 3 year? 3 times. And now 1-1 in 2024. She is not afraid of the top dog in women's tennis. She is not afraid of anybody in women's tennis. In fact, she can beat anybody in women's tennis.
And has.
So if she were, I know we've said this many times on the podcast before, but if she were to ever truly enter into a sustained purple patch, watch out.
Mm-hmm. I think what was impressive to me is that she has been able to recover from a few stumbles this season. It's only been 4 months. She wins Brisbane, beating Sabalenka in the final there quite decisively. Then has this Australian Open where she goes out early to Blinkova, right? Mm-hmm. It's Blinkova. Misses Indian Wells, where she was defending with an illness, comes back in Miami, plays these endless 3-set matches, gets outdone by Danielle Collins in the final, and here we are again, right? She continues to win finals despite these stumbles.
Her opponent in the final, Marta Kostyuk, her last 3 tournaments, this past week in Stuttgart making the final. Previously, she made the semifinals in Indian Wells, and then the week prior to that, the final in San Diego, losing to Katie Bolter. This, after making the quarterfinals at the Australian Open. This is somebody who is coming good on her talent in 2024, mm-hmm. regardless of how you feel about her.
How do I feel about her? Marta speaks her mind about everything, and good for her. Sloane Stephens. We saw her in Charleston. She won the doubles title. She loves clay. And look where she is in Rouen, France, a 250, recently upgraded from 125, winning her first title in over 2 years.
The 8th of her career.
First title on red clay. That's always a qualifier, right? Her first title on clay, except for Charleston. She, of course, has a runner-up finish at Roland Garros. We know she loves this surface. Sloane has been pretty honest lately talking about where her career is at and knowing that she probably doesn't have a ton of time left and that she wants to see some good signs, or it's like, well, what am I still doing out here? Well, this is a good sign.
She was pleased as punch on social media after winning this tournament. Mm-hmm. And I love that she showed up in just a simple red and white kit. Red top, white bottom, looked great against the clay. And did the business. It was a throwback in every sense for me.
Yeah. This tournament, despite being programmed against Stuttgart, had a really good field. We got Pavlyuchenkova, Garcia, Yuan Yue, Kalinina, Andreeva. And then Sloane had to beat Peyton Stearns, Pliskova, Yuan Garcia, Linette to win this title. That's a good week.
Good week. This, of course, following her doubles title in Charleston. So back-to-back tournaments, she's lifted a trophy.
Mm-hmm. The American women are making this Olympic bid a real fight.
Did you know that there was a Tyriac Open?
I do now. The old Tyriac Open, the Madrid Masters, when he used to own it. Well, the current Tyriac Open is a clay 250 held in Bucharest, Romania. Martin Fucsovics is the winner, beating Mariano Navone, who we mentioned a few episodes ago after Rio, because in Rio he had earned the first ATP-level wins of his career and now has 2 finals in the 2024 season already. That's all I really have to say about the Jan Tyriac Open. We'll be moving into Madrid shortly, which he used to own.
Wow.
The
Do you remember last year?
The favored daughter of this tournament will not be in attendance because she is injured.
That is true.
Madrid has the most consistently rotted vibes of any tournament on the tour, in my opinion. Last year, you just mentioned. What did happen last year?
Last year was Cake Gate, where Carlos Alcaraz was given a 17-tier cake that had to be carried out by horses to center court for his birthday.
Think Aladdin, like Prince Ali.
And world number two Aryna Sabalenka was given a Duncan Hines yellow cake in the locker room.
It was actually an Oreo.
And it elicited responses from quite a few folks within tennis, not least of which Victoria Azarenka, who said, you know, well, this checks out. This makes sense from this tournament. Mm-hmm. She, of course, goes on to make the final in doubles. She won, right? I think she won.
Yes, with Harad Maya.
And shockingly, nobody was allowed to speak in that final afterward. There was
no speeches.
No speeches. The women were literally silenced by Feliciana Lopez and that tournament. Mm-hmm. And I know some folks will say, well, what really is the role of the tournament director? It's just a figurehead. I don't care. You don't get to be the figurehead just for the good stuff.
And in that case, if a TD's role is mostly player-facing, then you really fumbled. Because the players were literally talking shit about your tournament during it.
And when you are on social media, laughing in their faces, while this is actively going on.
During and after.
Yeah. So this tournament is a dumpster fire of sexism and misogyny for decades. And the departure of Tyriac when he sold this tournament to IMG has not changed that. Previously, you could say, well, oh, I guess it's, you know, what do we expect? It's Jan Tyriac. You know, this is what he's done in tennis for all these years. But no, it is in the fabric of this event.
It turns out it's baked in.
We have a few tennis et ceteras to get into before we finish with a few pop culture et ceteras. Mikhail Emer. All of a sudden, he tweets saying, retirement was boring. See you in eight months.
Speaking of Messi, that's not surprising. It's only 18 months and he's young. He was just mad.
He was big mad when he was given a suspension because of whereabouts violations with anti-doping control. And now he's planning to come back to tennis. Who is not planning to come back to tennis is Garbiñe Muguruza, who yesterday announced her retirement from tennis at 30 years old.
This won't come as a huge surprise. She hasn't played a match since January of 2023. And she said she was taking an indefinite break from the sport. Has been seemingly living her best life, enjoying it. But it's still surprising to see a player so young and who had so much success just call it a day. Her career was always pretty up and down. She had big wins over very important people, a Hall of Fame career no doubt, winning two slams, both of them in finals over Williams sisters. Nobody's ever done that.
John Wertheim tweeted about, you know, this is a Hall of Fame career. And people in the comments are like, is it? You're telling on yourself.
Well, I also, like, you can disagree, but that means you haven't seen the type of players who have been inducted in the Hall of Fame.
You haven't been paying attention.
So this is learn the criteria.
This is a 2-time slam champion, a 4-time slam finalist. She's beaten everybody that there is to beat in tennis. Who matters? What you may be hung up on is that this is a career that didn't live up to the expectations that everybody put on her.
Right.
I don't know what she put on herself, but when Garbiñe was winning Wimbledon in 2016, when Garbiñe was reaching the final of Wimbledon in 2015, winning the French Open in 2016, winning Wimbledon in 2017, 7 years ago, at the age of 23, this felt like a career with so much all-time great potential. Mm-hmm. And then she went through the doldrums, came back to make the final in 2020 in Australia, losing to Kenin. Even then, she comes back and wins Guadalajara, wins the WTA Championships. She had such high highs in her career to go with the lows. It was a roller coaster. Mm-hmm. She was a player whose game you would watch when it's unsung and think, how in the world is this woman not a 6-7 time slam champion? Why does she have such few WTA title wins? She won, I say only, but she won only 10 WTA titles.
Mm-hmm. Two of those were slams. One of those was the WTA finals. One was Cincinnati.
When she was bad, she was historically bad. You know, like it wasn't always fun to watch when she was going through her bad periods. But through it all, she served charm. She served shade in multiple languages.
A lot of classic quotes.
Right. A lot of classic reactions. I think she is the player most emblematic of this transition period from the Serena, what do you call it in music? When Stevie Wonder releases.
Oh, like her imperial period?
Yes. The transition from Serena's imperial era to what comes next. She was seen as one of the players to bridge that gap, mm-hmm. one of the next ones. And it may turn out that we just may never get that again. And big surprise that we may not. Because it is absurd what Serena Williams did in her career. To the point where Venus Williams' 7 slams doesn't even really register to most folks
mm-hmm.
in the grand scheme of things.
When there are very few players who've ever won 7 slams in singles, not to mention 14 in doubles. But back to Garbiñe, beating Serena at Roland Garros in 2014 decisively, like really beating her, was a huge announcement of her talent. Then beating her in the final 2 years later, of course, one of our most heartbreaking matches ever was the 2017 Wimbledon final, in which Venus and Garbiñe played a really tight competitive first set, but then Garbi ran away with the second. She had what it takes when it mattered.
She was the 24th woman to be WTA number one shortly after winning Cincinnati in 2017. We were there covering that entire tournament. We were there for that ride. Happy in retrospect to have witnessed it.
Yeah.
She was one of the players that really brought your mother into women's tennis, I would say.
Yeah, yeah, that's true.
That match against Madison Keys in Cincinnati.
Mm-hmm. Damn, Madison is always there, but too often on the losing end of those matches.
Yeah. I'm happy for her. You know my position on this when people have been clowning Muguruza over the last few years, especially during her hiatus, looking at her spin classes, her yoga, her this.
Zumba.
All the dancing videos, all the things that she's doing off the tennis court, but not doing what she should be doing. This is what she should be doing.
Right.
She's a very rich woman. And if, like Mari Osaka, it's no longer a journey that you're ultimately enjoying, live your life. While we were in Charleston, the WTA announced finally that they will be partnering with the Saudis for their year-end championships.
This was the worst kept secret in tennis. Everybody knew that this announcement was coming. They'll be in Riyadh, Saudi Arabia for a 3-year deal to hold the year-end championships, offering a record prize money of $15.25 million, which is currently higher than the men's. So I expect the men will increase that in like 2-2s.
If history is any indicator, because the last time the women offered higher year-end prize money
in Shenzhen,
it was like the day after.
Yeah.
The ATP was like, well, here, look at us, guys.
We've increased ours by like 2% just to be higher.
It was like the Price is Right.
Yeah. 1,001. Oh, that made me so mad. Anyway, the Saudi Tennis Federation is currently led by a woman named Arij Mutabagani. She's the first woman to ever lead a Saudi sports federation. One of the big questions was, what will it be like for players who are LGBTQ? Will they be safe coming to this country?
And of course, the figurehead of that debate, the person that people point to, is Dasha Kasatkina.
Right, because I don't know where all the lesbians went, but there are not that many lesbians at the top of women's tennis anymore.
Out lesbians.
There was a time,
yeah,
as you know.
And as we know from being on the ground in Charleston, Dasha is very unapologetically queer.
Yes,
with her partner. Yes.
Natalia's always there. They vlogging, show affection publicly.
Vlogging all over the place. And I guess by default, then she becomes the person that people point to. Is that fair to her?
Mm-hmm.
This is one of the things legitimately that people point to when they say, well, why don't we have an openly gay men's player? Well, we have one on the WTA tour, and these are the quote unquote burdens that she has to now deal with by default. It's not a small matter that somebody should then become the de facto champion crusader because they're the only one.
Or victim.
Right.
Of this choice to go to Saudi Arabia.
Exactly.
Right?
Because of who they are and because of deciding to live out in the open, they now have to deal with so much more on a day-to-day basis than other players. And we take it for granted that, oh my God, this is so amazing. We love this. We love seeing Natasha. We love seeing Dasha. It's so great. It's so heartwarming. But there's so much more involved than we will ever know.
Also, Dasha might not even qualify for the finals. But it shows you that it's important that movements have an actual human being to glom onto, because otherwise a lot of people don't understand it. Like, they actually do not know how to empathize unless they can put that on a real person who they feel they know. You know, otherwise it's like, oh, okay, whatever, gays and lesbians aren't safe there. What does that mean? And they don't know what it means until it affects somebody they know or think they know.
Right. And so you say we have guarantees that Dasha and Natasha will be able to stay together in the same room. They won't be discriminated against. But on a week-to-week basis, when I show up to a tournament as Dasha, I'm relied upon to create content. My partner is welcomed in those spaces. My partner is part of the story of women's tennis, celebrated even. We saw that no two ways about it in Charleston.
Mm-hmm.
So then do I qualify for the year in championships, the big celebration event of the year? And fine, she can come, but she won't be part of the promo stuff. She won't be able to go to the gala. She won't be able to do this. I can't kiss her in public.
But you can stay together in the same room. For me, that's a non-starter, right? When we're thinking about places to vacation, we're going places where we feel safe.
Mm.
I'm not making this like a tourism thing, right? But I would never consider going somewhere where I wasn't going to be safe.
Right. But your point is that it's an absolute consideration for queer people all over the world with traveling, whether it's for work,
mm-hmm.
whether it's for vacation. The countries that you step foot in as a queer person, we make very pointed choices about where we go.
And I'm also not going to a place to purposely violate their laws and put myself in jeopardy because I'm an American and I think I have that right. I'm just not going to go.
Which is to say, it's far more complicated than just giving this little brush-off answer. Like, we have assurances. There's so much more within that.
There's been so much discourse about this, and so much of this is clouded by geopolitical biases. I saw Wertheim said that, you know, last year Everett and Navratilova had the moral courage to speak up against this. Guys, like, speaking out against Islamic states from the West is not courageous.
It is not.
It's normal, right? That perplexed me.
Aiding and abetting the subjugation and oppression of your fellow queer people in your own country, that is cowardice. So don't come.
Oh yeah, but
don't come to me with
but
this
she would
is
say
courageous.
They're not part of the same community.
I'm not giving any credence to
exactly.
that. I'm just saying
exactly.
This is why miss me with all of that.
Mm-hmm. Anyway, this week in Madrid, there's going to be meetings all week about the proposed changes to tennis, which include the proposal from the Saudi Public Investment Fund, the competing bid from the Slams, which is that premier tour. There are going to be meetings with both tours, boards of director meetings toward the end of the week. Will we have any big decisions that come from this week? Maybe, maybe not. But things are moving along.
Terrible news for Storm Hunter. Previously, she had ascended to world number one in doubles. She's been playing well this year. She ruptured her Achilles in practice and has already undergone surgery. Will be out 4 to 6 months. She's currently the world number three in doubles, semifinalist in Australia, Indian Wells runner-up, and the winner in Dubai. That's rough.
Mm-hmm. Challengers is coming out soon, this Thursday, actually. Luca Guadagnino is the director of Call Me By Your Name. Whatever happens, it will have odd psychosexual themes. That's guaranteed.
That's what you're leading with?
It's a tennis movie, by the way. That's the headline.
Uh-huh. It stars Zendaya, Josh O'Connor, and some other white dude.
Mike Feist from West Side Story.
Two weird-looking white dudes. That's all I know.
Josh O'Connor played Prince Charles on The Crown and was in God's Own Country.
Mm-hmm. It's gotten great reviews to start. Yes. I haven't seen one bad review about it to date.
Mm-hmm.
And that we are given a tennis film that is legitimate, it feels like a big win, regardless. Because we don't get this very often. We were just watching Elsbeth last night, the spin-off of The Good Wife to then The Good Fight. And now Elsbeth has her own show, Elsbeth Tassioni. And, I mean, I don't love it, to be honest. It's a bit too formulaic for me. Jessica Fletcher did it way better back in the day. So we'll have to see how that plays out. But on one of the episodes, the last one we watched, it was a tennis episode. The murder happened in the world of tennis. Somebody who had retired was coming back to the sport, and this other guy was not too pleased about it. And so his daddy went and inadvertently murdered him. And guess who guest starred on that show? A tennis commentator who, as it turns out, could not play a tennis commentator on TV because it was horrendous.
Wow.
Patrick McEnroe. Why did I say that? What's the... Oh, yes. We deserve good things in tennis from film and TV. And so I'm glad that this is happening. As for Zendaya, the looks that she's been serving.
Law Roach, her stylist, is currently only working with Zendaya. Law said that he had basically retired from being a stylist. But there he is on every stop with Zendaya. She's giving tennis looks. She did an umpire look. You know, you got a lot of vintage kind of Wimbledon things.
She is the preeminent movie star of the day. Oh, the day. When it comes to serving looks.
Yes, but this is really her first time that she is leading a big film, right? She's been famous for a long time.
Sure, I'm just saying that she has been that girl on the red carpet for a long time now. So if that is your one client, that is the one to have.
Mm-hmm. So some journalists, of course, have had the chance to see this. Some went to the premiere. I am jealous. I'm not afraid to admit that. We will have our thoughts on Challengers as soon as we can possibly see this movie.
You've said privately and publicly, I believe, on the show that one of your life goals was to appear on Dasha's vlog.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And as it turns out, inadvertently, you did.
Now I have.
You have.
Officially.
We just finished watching Dasha's Charleston episode. And at the sushi event, you were there for all of it. I came toward the end and we're watching it. And you're like, where am I? Where am I? I'm like, well, you must be there based on the angle.
Mm-hmm.
It's just a Where's Waldo thing. And eventually I'm like, stop, 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 stop. There you are. There you are. There you are. You're like, where? I can't see it. Where am I? Where am I? And then so I had to get up and physically point at the TV screen to show you where you were.
It's like the Zapruder film. I am actually in it somewhere.
If you want to go try and find him,
please don't.
Is that he's seated.
And I will remind you that it was an accident that I was even there. I was just chilling and having lunch. And they show up for this event.
Sure.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. That concludes the tennis et ceteras. Now we're going to do a couple pop culture et ceteras.
You call it that, but this is Cowboy Carter. It's not an et cetera.
Well, because you have no desire to speak about the two things I want to speak about.
Okay.
Some of y'all have been wanting us to talk about Cowboy Carter. We're going to do that. Before then, Keith Lee, TikTok food critic, showed up in Toronto and went to all these places and gave his reviews. And by and large, the Toronto scene for him was amazing, which Kel Supries.
He was smart to go to Scarborough, to go to Weston for Bahamian food, you know, not just look for downtown stuff.
Not on King Street.
Exactly.
My first introduction to this dude was when there was some big kerfuffle on Twitter about him calling out this restaurant and the treatment.
In Atlanta,
yeah,
right?
Yeah. And it went on for a while. And he hasn't penetrated my algorithm on TikTok, so I haven't been getting his videos. But since he was in Toronto, I was legitimately interested to see what he was going to say and where he went. Now, he went to this Caribbean restaurant and got a bunch of stuff. And when I tell you my disbelief that this Black American could roll up to Toronto, go to a Jamaican restaurant and then say, oh, you know, this is pretty good. I've never had goat before, but it's all right. That immediately discredited everything for me. I will never listen to anything this man has to say again, ever.
Because he had never had goat before.
Never. Never. It was almost as if he'd never even conceived of the notion that one could have goat, let alone curry it.
I am surprised, though, because it's common also in Indian food.
It's not a Jamaican thing.
Yeah, yeah.
It's other Caribbean cultures. It's other cultures globally. So many people eat goat. It's not crazy. Which is fine. Not everybody has to have eaten everything. But you've been at this game for a while now. And I'm supposed to be listening to your perspective as like something. You know, it just really, it pissed me off. I'm not even going to lie. It pissed me off. And I know you're sitting there like, this is not a big deal. Why is it even on the podcast? But I was disgusted.
I actually felt bad for the restaurant because he doesn't announce himself, right? And a lot of people don't know who he is. He's trying to get an authentic experience as a customer, which is cool. Like, is great. You know, he's not getting his meals paid for and stuff. I know he normally sends somebody else in, like his family, so he doesn't get recognized. But I think he said he went in to these places. But anyway, the young woman who was working there said she was hungover and it just wasn't like the most amazing customer service experience, which, I know this is a common joke on social media, but have you ever been to a Jamaican restaurant? It's a different approach to customer service.
If there are 20 things on the menu, you are lucky if 7 are available. And so if you're going for authentic, you got it. And the nerve to then put this woman's job in jeopardy. Let's be real.
Yeah.
But you're telling me you don't know who you are and what your reach is, that this is not going to come back to this worker. Like, this is a minimum wage worker whose job you've just endangered. Mm-hmm. And for what? It was not necessary to the experience.
And so I think when you get this level of fame, you have a lot of power, right? Restaurants are begging you to come to their places. So many restaurants are struggling, and he typically goes to smaller businesses, like family-run places. They need this kind of exposure, you know, like profit margins are so tiny. And so I just, you know, that comes with a lot of responsibility, and it makes me feel bad that this restaurant got like a so-so review from him. Then again, like he went to Old Nassau, which is a Bahamian place on the West End, and they've gotten this huge bump, and the owner is very grateful. He went to this Black-owned pizzeria downtown, left them a $3,000 tip, and what they did with it was give out free food all day. Like, he does a lot of good stuff, right? Yeah. I don't follow him because I don't like watching people eat. That's just a personal thing for me.
Do you know how many times
okay,
my listen. Ears are assaulted because we could be watching TV and somebody's chewing on chips, somebody's breathing too loud on the TV, somebody's sniffing. Just the other day, Jimmy Butler was sniffing something on TV.
No, we were watching the NBA game, and then there's this commercial, and Jimmy Butler and somebody else are, for 30 seconds in a row, like, sniffing some tea or something. And it's supposed to be annoying. I understand that's like a marketing strategy. You know those car commercials where they're screaming? They're screaming at you? Like, that's a strategy, too?
But you have no chill. Like, you go from 0 to 2,000 so quickly. Like, you start screaming. Like, oh my God, stop it, stop it. Like, you frantically look for the remote. It just envelops me.
I know other people feel this. It's called something. It has a name.
I'm sure other people feel it, and I understand it. I'm just saying your reaction to it, which I have to deal with, is a lot.
But I can't explain to you what it makes me feel like. You know, when you're watching a commercial and somebody chomps really, really hard on a chip and then it keeps happening, I understand why people kill. In that moment. Oh, I'm so sorry. I'm supposed to say unalive.
I think we need to move on. To Mariah Carey in Las Vegas. She is doing a residency celebrating the 20th anniversary of The Emancipation of Mimi, her big comeback, don't call it a comeback album. And I am just floored by the looks, the vocals, the performances, her happiness on stage. It is such a departure from what we've seen in the last couple of years. And in taking it in, I was so pleased and just watching every video I could find. And I made the mistake of going to the comments, thinking that this is a universally celebrated moment, only to find the trolls and the fans of has-beens who are telling lies. They're telling lies.
Saying the whole thing is lipped.
That only 5% of the show is live, which made me feel so gaslit. Because I tell people, I could teach a university level course on Mariah Carey and her career and so many different... I could teach a degree. There could be like 30 classes on this, right? And so for me to be watching these videos and sure, she sings with a backing track, who doesn't? But to then say it's 5% live and then to be questioning my reality, I was so resentful because it then cut into my enjoyment of the moment, which I'd been waiting for such a long time. Never really thinking that I could experience this again where she's in such great vocal shape and personal happiness. They're tethered together for her. And it really just highlighted for me how deeply seedy and nasty the internet is. It's just not a good place to exist if you're looking for joy.
No, I mean, stan culture is rotted.
It is horrendous. When in fact, the person who Mariah famously doesn't know released a documentary, released a film, released an album, released tour dates, and nothing is selling above 10% capacity. And so the fans are so pressed that they've taken to the comments to ruin other people's joy. Yeah. It's a combination of delusion and dark-sidedness in such great concentration that it is hard to believe. Mm.
If you think the whole thing is lipped, you must think she has like 5 different recordings of the same song to cycle through and then mime every night. Because it, first of all, the performances change and Mariah is not that good at lip syncing.
She's one of the worst lip syncers in the history of the world. In the history of popular music.
It's usually quite obvious, actually.
And so I heard somebody say in the comments, specifically with the Vision of Love performance, where she changes the arrangement and then at the end of the song she does a whistle where it would normally be just, you know, a big run moment, you know? And night 2, the whistle was different than night 1. Yeah. And so this person said, well, obviously she recorded 2 different versions in the studio with her current voice to then throw you off the scent that she's lip syncing.
Right. But then it'll be 3 versions and 4 versions and 5 versions.
And so not only has she brushed up on her lip syncing for it to be undetectable that way, but she's also gone into the studio and recorded this new version of the song twice, specifically to alter that note so that we don't think that she's... It's mental. It is... And this is one of the hardest parts of being a Mariah stan, is that when she's on and at the peak of her powers, and even to this day, her tone is unrivaled. Her tone is one that is difficult to understand, to be real. And I think that's where a lot of it stems from. Like when she's able to still hit notes like she did prior or sing in a tone like she did when she was 22 years old, people cannot fathom that it's real.
Mm. But also, I don't care if she can still belt an F or a G. Like, it's not realistic to still expect that. She does different things.
And also, the new arrangements are interesting.
Yeah.
Which is way more than you can say for those who wish that they were born in the 1830s, just without the racism and the misogyny.
I think it's a good segue. You have not left me a lot of time. We're supposed to do like a whole album review of Cowboy Carter.
I only did like 5 minutes.
Okay. But, well, who knows how long this episode will be. We don't actually have a time slot, so we can talk as long as we want to. Cowboy Carter, Act 2 of the Renaissance Cycle, was released on Good Friday. We purposely have taken a long time before kind of saying anything about it. The Friday that it came out, you and I sat here on the couch and turned on Spotify and streamed the whole album.
Your attention span was struggling that night.
Right. Well, because I wanted to keep stopping it, first of all, like starting and stopping. And the album is long. I did not know. I don't look at track lists before. I don't really care. Like, I turn on the album and I was like, damn, 27 tracks.
But they're not all songs. Right. There's interludes. There's Willie Nelson. There's Dolly P.
The album is an experience. And the experience of listening to it for the first time is something that I will never forget. But being able to sit with it and digest it over the past month or so has been super important because it's even grown my appreciation of what this is. I remember in February at the Super Bowl, it was becoming evident what Renaissance really was, like the immensity of what Renaissance was supposed to mean or the meaning that we were putting into it. And I just got like overwhelmed. Like, I can't believe she's doing this. Like, this is crazy. You know, this is a country album or whatever. And it turns out it's so much more than a country album.
I think that was a little bit confusing. I think you're thinking of Renaissance Acts 1, 2, and 3 as Renaissance.
Okay, as like the name of the whole cycle.
Yeah, so what you're saying is that it became clear that Act 2, what we came to know as Cowboy Carter, would be significant.
Yes, and I think what we were starting to understand about whatever she meant by Acts 1, 2, 3 was starting to become like, oh, so this is actually a career-defining work. And it has an overarching goal or purpose, or at least a theme, to sort of decolonize a lot of genres that were once originated by Black people and now are not associated with Black people.
Not associated? Not would you say co-opted?
Sure.
Pilfered.
Appropriated?
Even. Yeah.
And the thing that I think we've lost sight of with cultural studies is like appropriation isn't just kind of pretending and putting on a different culture. There's a political, economic part of appropriation.
There's a sinister element to it because It's not just dabbling. It's economically benefiting from, and when it no longer suits your benefit, then you dip.
There's a disenfranchisement aspect of it, that it's not just the right wing likes to talk about virtue signaling and wokeness and all this stuff, but there's an actual cost to appropriation. And Beyoncé, with Cowboy Carter, has expanded this idea even further and is talking about the cost of building a country, right? There's so many references to the history of this country, to a pretty house that we never settled in.
Right after we were in Charleston.
Right after we were in Charleston. So there is like the very literal reading of that line, this beautiful house that we built that we didn't get to live in. And of course, there's this country that they built and do not see the political, cultural, or economic gains from.
Whole lot of red in that white and blue.
Right? And so there is a political meaning to Cowboy Carter, but even though the music is very dense and thematic, it is so listenable. And it's, to me, has gotten more pleasurable the more times I've heard it.
It's the most I've ever enjoyed Beyoncé's voice. And I don't say this to be inflammatory. I'm very much a new convert to being a Beyoncé stan. Right. And that I've always liked her music. But even to this day, when I think of the vocalists who move me, she's not even in my top 10. And I don't mean that as a negative to Beyoncé. It's just what it is. You know, like the way Mariah's voice moves me, Aretha's did, Whitney's did. I don't have that same relationship, right? And so my coming of age with Beyoncé in terms of really coming on board started with Lemonade, truly.
Right.
Like, I'd always been a fan. I never disliked Beyoncé, but I became a fan with Lemonade. I started to find her work interesting. That's the thing that I find most interesting about Beyoncé, especially in her 30s onward, like what she's done with her output. It's crazy. Mm-hmm. The Lemonade to Renaissance to Cowboy Carter path, that trajectory, who matches that? Stevie Wonder?
Right. That's where we are now, right? So let's, well, first talk about the voice. I said when we talked about Renaissance that I had never heard her sound this good on a record. We got to see her in person, and yeah, She was singing the vast majority of the show live, despite what you make think. Everybody uses playback, but we got Beyonce opening for Beyonce, right? We got Beyonce singing some ballads right at the beginning of Renaissance before it became like a ballroom thing. And the voices, I mean, I just do not understand at age 42 how you've maintained this type of power and how your tone has been enriched and deepened.
It's the same, not to make it white, but it's the same with Kelly Clarkson. We have the yes. same conversations about these two women.
I don't understand how her voice has gotten better. On this album, I think you hear colors of Beyonce's voice that we haven't really heard before. Like, we know she has power. We know that she is agile and can do melisma. But, I mean, the way she uses her voice on Bodyguard, when she says, honey, honey, the way she's using her voice on Yaya or American Requiem, like, and then, of course, the bel canto on Daughter, when she goes into an Italian art song. I just don't think we've ever heard her use her voice and her registers so disparately, like in such a wide-ranging way.
Which is ironic, because I find it to be her most restrained vocal performance on an album.
Right.
Which, it is one of the greatest lessons that less is often more. You know, they're the 1-2-3 start to this album is so heavy, yet ethereal. There's an airiness to her vocals. When she sings the words American Requiem, she's never sounded better to me. That is one of the most sonically pleasing things I've ever heard in my life. But it is still within the context of a song that is culturally very heavy.
Mm-hmm.
And so you have this dichotomy of beautiful, airy vocals with really heavy subject matter that's rooted in the history of the United States.
Having American Requiem start the album and Amen ending it, and they're both sonically very similar, is obviously like setting the tone thematically. So we understand what this album is about. The move toward live instruments and kind of imperfect vocal production is really effective. And I don't know if it's just because, well, this genre demanded it, but I think it's a really good musical choice, because so much of musical production these days, and Beyonce's own production, is too perfect sometimes.
Yes, right? Like, another one of my critiques of Beyonce over the years.
The vocal production is pristine, it's skillful, but like everything lines up perfectly, right? You can make these things in digital recording that you can't do in the analog era. And sometimes it's cool to break out of that. So American Requiem, when you talked about them singing that final chorus, there's Beyonce, there's a number of other singers, they have different vibratos, they're cutting off at different times. It sounds real, like it sounds like they're a chorus recording live in a studio. And that's what I appreciated throughout the album. Through Bodyguard, for example, Rafael Sadiq wrote a lot of the music on the album. He played every instrument except the drums on Bodyguard. And his bass, like bouncing along the beat and propelling that song, is one of the highlights of the song. And the song is one of the highlights of the album. So I really love to hear that move toward live instruments. Rhiannon Giddens playing the banjo.
American Requiem into Blackbird, which we now know, we don't need to tell you what the meaning of that song is originally and or why it's on this album, but you get a very stripped down vocal performance from Beyonce on that.
Mm-hmm.
It is so simple and effective. And then that goes into 16 Carriages, which purportedly documents her loss of childhood in support of her family.
And then it moves into kind of taking time away from her family to build legacy, which really the past decade of her career has been eschewing the commercial success. I don't really think she cares if she gets number one singles. Starting with the self-titled in 2013 was this move toward, now I'm building a body of work that I want to remain, like after I'm done doing this. And that's part of what 16 Carriages is about, like putting all of this into building legacy. And is it worth it?
I know you told me that you didn't necessarily see it or hear it, but the lashes, you know, like when you
yes,
when you like what is that word? The actual thing like that used to hit the horses.
Crack, like the reins or whatever?
Yeah, the reins for the horses. Mm-hmm. That conjured something more for me.
Something more sinister.
Something more sinister. Which I don't know if that's the case. And if it is or if it's not, maybe it's up for interpretation. But that added to the heaviness of the first three tracks for me.
And even
I don't think I need to spell that out.
Even if it's not intentional, it is a part of the theme of this album, right? You wouldn't be totally off base for thinking that.
And it's not dissimilar from... people think of this as Renaissance to Cowboy Carter to whatever Act 3 is, but the roots of this come from Lemonade as well.
Mm-hmm.
That scene with Beyoncé in her hat outside the Great House.
Right.
In Formation.
Yes.
Thematically, I see a correlation between that and 16 Carriages. I see traces throughout the work that this didn't just originate here.
And Beyoncé was not always a political performer. We sort of take that for granted now, but when Beyoncé appeared in front of the word feminist back in, I think, 2013, that was not something to be taken for granted because she normally was not overtly political in her work, right? And she has become that way since. But during Lemonade, we saw Beyoncé on top of a police car that was flooding in New Orleans. Like, this was very clear allusions to Katrina, to the inequality that let that happen to Black people in New Orleans. And now she's using genre as a way to explore American history through the eyes of Black people.
Genres, a fun little thing.
Right. And so when Linda Martell says genres, it moves the album from, okay, this is Beyoncé's country album, to this is Beyoncé's Beyoncéist album. This is Beyoncé's American album.
This is Beyoncé singing an album entitled Music, parentheses, Beyoncé's version.
Right? Right, because we're going to hear an interpolation of the Beach Boys. We're going to hear homages to Chitlin Circuit, to the Ike and Tina Turner Review.
Which we never talked about, that Chitlin Circuit WTA poster.
I didn't like it.
That was not it.
So,
like, decidedly not it.
Yeah.
Anyway.
So Beyoncé put out a poster in the style of a Chitlin Circuit poster. And for those of you who don't know, the Chitlin Circuit was a circuit of venues, mostly in the South, where Black performers played. And so many,
where they could make money safely.
Exactly.
So white people weren't part of this. And so with the WTA putting out this Chitlin Circuit poster of the winners in 2024, and there is how many Black people on it?
I mean, Jasmine Paolini was the only non-white person.
Let's be real here. Can we be for real?
Mm. I understand that you are picturing the winners, but you didn't have to do this at all.
No.
So I know this is not my white business, but for me it was like, oh.
It was a cute visual, but you clearly are bereft of any cultural understanding.
Right. I think like what's resonating with me with Beyoncé's work more recently is the continuity, the sense of communion with people and things that came before me, before her, right? And again, this is like, I'm a tourist in this. This is about the continuity of the Black experience in America. Part of that is with genre, is with smashing all of these different songs together in one of the interludes, right? You have a country song, you have Sister Rosetta Tharpe, Chuck Berry, and you start to understand that these supposedly distinct genres are, in fact, quite interrelated. Country, gospel, R&B, rock are all of a part. And all of those were either completely authored by Black people or in part. The song Protector is one that, like, I can't really listen to without crying because it's so moving. But it's not only about her child. It's not only about Rumi. It's about this connection to people who came before. This line, there's a long line of hands carrying your name, lifting you up so you will be raised. This connection to her own lineage, these references to Alabama and Louisiana, and just the idea that a history that was intentionally stolen and erased is being claimed again is so powerful.
Claimed, but also still demeaned.
Right.
The way... I don't know. It's just not a game. It's not a game. What Beyoncé is doing now is not a game. It's not just a pop game where you can payola the radio and say, well, I have this many chart successes and so I am better. She's beyond that. She's moved beyond that. When people want to be dichotomous and compare her to, say, Taylor Swift and try and debate the merits of it. They're not playing the same game. And that doesn't make Taylor's work bad, despite what I feel about it. It doesn't make Beyoncé's necessarily good. You know, it's not the same thing. And what I've respected is that, as you said, Beyoncé has taken herself out of that game. She don't care.
Right.
She's doing what she wants to do. All other things be damned. And you can listen to us talk about what this album is, what we think it is. And you can listen to five other people talk about it, and they come to you with totally different things, different interpretations. This is what great art is.
Mm-hmm. And I honestly welcome the critique too. I welcome what Bell Hooks wrote about Beyoncé, even though I don't agree with all of it, but the black capitalism critique.
Oh, for sure.
Right? That's obviously there, right? This is a history claimed, but also commodified, of course. But I just feel like at this point, you really cannot deny the music. It is really that good. And part of it is Beyoncé, and part of it is Rafael Sadiq and The Dream, and all of the country collaborators, and Dolly Parton. But at this point, the music is important. It's listenable. It's fun. At 42, this 25 years after being a star, you're still producing on this level. You're shifting culture on this level. Nobody does that.
Okay. I struggle with that part of it. The heaping on of the praise of being such a culturally relevant icon.
Okay.
Kind of thing.
Okay, just fine. Take away all that. Which of the icons 25 years later was making music of this quality? And the list gets small.
Right. I think what's the most important takeaway from me with this is that it's immaterial to qualify the music, which is where I'm coming from with that.
Mm.
I don't care. I don't need to place it against something else. I don't even need to place it against her preceding work. Initially, I thought, I'm not even sure this is better than Renaissance or even better than Lemonade. Lemonade would always have a special place in for me, you know?
Mm.
And then I was like, it doesn't matter. One day I'll wake up and I'll feel like listening to Lemonade. Yeah. And then another day I'll wake up and feel like listening to Renaissance, which is part of the purpose. It's giving different vibes. It's giving different meaning. It's giving different reasons, you know? And this album, maybe it's proving that it's genreless. Maybe it's proving that it's boundaryless. Maybe it's proving that we just don't need to compare Beyoncé to other people or even to herself. The work just exists in and of itself, and it's great.
Okay, period.
Yeah. Thanks for listening. My name is Jonathan. You can find me on Twitter at @tennis_John.
And I'm James at @ElliotJMR.
Two L's, two T's. Everything BodyServe related can be found at linktree.com/thebodyserve. Good luck to us editing this episode and getting it out in a timely manner. Thanks for listening.
Till next time.
Thank you very much.